You are listening to Mountain Money, broadcasting from KPCW, Park City, Utah. Good morning. I feel like we might be having some problems with your mic there, Roger.
Okay. Yeah, we are. Let me go to a different mic.
All right. But welcome to KPCW's Mountain Money. Today is Monday, March 22nd. My name is Allison Kulo, and I am here with my co-host, Roger Goldman. Good morning, Roger.
Good morning, Allison. Is that better?
Nope.
Let's try that again.
Good morning, Allison?
No.
Okay.
I'm not getting you anywhere.
Well, you're going to have to go on without me for a few minutes.
Well, goodness gracious. So where we're at this morning, we've got quite a number of guests coming, and we're excited to do that. This morning, we've got Michael Strain. He's the Director of Economic Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute. He's going to join us to discuss how a $15 minimum wage may harm workers. Susan Madsen, Professor of Leadership at John M. Huntsman School of Business at Utah State University. Spends time with us this morning to talk about COVID-19's impact on women to the workforce. And finally, we're going to end the hour learning about Kiln Park City, set to open up in New Park on April 1st.
Sounds like a great show, Allison. We'll have all this and more on Mountain Money. It was 2007 that Steve Jobs stood on a platform and introduced the iPhone. Seems like a long time ago, doesn't it? It's also the last time that Congress voted to increase the minimum wage to its present rate of $7.25 an hour. The House passed legislation in 2019 to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. Joe Biden advocated for such an increase during the 2020 campaign, and it was in the most recent COVID relief bill when it first passed the House, although the Senate parliamentarian ruled it could not be included in a bill passed by the Senate through reconciliation. Democrats have vowed to continue the so-called fight for 15, with Senator Bernie Sanders proclaiming this will not be the last time Republicans will have to vote on it.
Last week, we focused one element of the proposed minimum wage legislation, the elimination of the tipped minimum wage. Today, we're going to discuss some of the broader implications of the bill. The Congressional Budget Office projects that, on the one hand, enacting such an increase would lift almost a million Americans out of poverty. But on the other hand, CBO estimates that employment would be reduced by 1.4 million workers. There are clearly real trade-offs involved in any proposed minimum wage increase, and the $15 an hour proposal is not the only one being discussed. Indeed, Utah's own Senator Romney has proposed an increase to $10 an hour with Senator Tom Cotton. So what are the appropriate principles to apply when evaluating minimum wage policy? What do economists tell us we should expect if a $15 wage were to become the law? And doesn't it make sense to index the minimum wage to inflation so Congress does not have to revisit this repeatedly? We are lucky this morning to be joined by Michael Strain, the Director of Economic Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute, a premier center-right think tank. Welcome to Mountain Money.
Thanks so much for having me on. It's great to be with you.
Good morning. Let's start with a conceptual framework. As an economist, what would you characterize the role that minimum wage plays in the labor market?
In the labor market.
Well, the minimum wage is a wage floor. And so the minimum wage is essentially a labor market regulation that requires employers to pay at least the amount of the wage floor to workers who were covered by the regulation. At this point, most workers are covered by the regulation. And so it's part of a suite of labor market regulations that include regulations on hours. That's where overtime laws come from, and regulations on wages, in this case, the minimum.
So the issue of what the so-called fight for 15 is proclaimed as a matter of equity, a matter of fairness. There's all kinds of rhetoric that surrounds it. What are your concerns about what would happen if, in fact, minimum wage was raised from $7.25 to 15? It seems like an awfully big jump.
Well, it is a big jump, and a jump that big would have a number of effects, and it would leave some workers better off, and it would leave some workers worse off. And one of the frustrating things about the debate over the minimum wage is that neither side neither proponents nor opponents of a higher minimum wage seem to want to acknowledge those trade-offs. On the upside, you would give a raise to millions and millions of workers. In your setup, you referenced the report by the Congressional Budget Office, and they also found that you would give a pay bump to lots and lots of workers. That's a good thing. At the same time, by making it more expensive for businesses to employ a worker, you would see a reduction in employment opportunities for workers, particularly for workers with relatively fewer skills and with relatively less experience. And so that's the downside. When you're talking about a minimum wage going up to 15, I think another really important factor to consider is what that would do to consumer prices. I think you would see a lot of businesses raise their prices. And since lower wage workers are more likely to be customers at businesses that employ lower wage workers, then you're also, taking income out of their pockets through that mechanism as well.
So again, I think how you're tying it is well said as far as how is that impacting the business? How are they able to then pay the employees, which is looking like now more than twice of what the current minimum wage is? Researching this, I found it interesting, and I had not thought of this way per se, but you know, it's linking, another thought to think of it is linking the wage to productivity. And what is that employee doing? And how is that then benefiting the business owner when they start to put together, you know, how everything, you know, their P&L and how everything balances?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think it's really helpful to kind of step back and say, you know, where do wages come from? And that actually is a subtext of this debate that really deserves more direct attention. In my view, and I think the solid weight of the economic evidence suggests that the most important driver of wages is productivity. So if you are a worker, say you're a worker at a fast food restaurant, by being employed, by working for an hour as a cashier or helping to prepare meals, you are adding to the amount of revenue that the firm generates. And maybe you're adding $7 an hour of revenue. Maybe you're adding $10 an hour of revenue. Maybe you're adding $12 an hour of revenue. But that's the reason the business is hiring you. That's the reason you're employed, is because by working for that hour, you are generating revenue that otherwise wouldn't be generated. And so the kind of fundamental question is, you know, if a worker is generating 10 bucks an hour in revenue for every hour that he or she works, does it make sense for a business to pay that worker $15 an hour? And the answer is no, because the business would be losing $5 an hour for every hour that worker worked. The worker would be generating 10 bucks an hour in revenue, but it would cost the business $15 an hour to employ that worker. And so the business would be losing $5 an hour every hour that employee was on the job. And so that's the kind of, you know, basic thought experiment that I think is really helpful when thinking about whether it makes sense to have a wage floor, particularly a wage floor as high as 15. There are, of course, other relevant factors at play. And so, you know, one thing a business might do, and I think there's good evidence to support this, is raise prices. And so that's a way that it can absorb the cost of the higher minimum wage. And so kind of overall, the business ends up doing okay. Another thing that businesses can do is it can change the types of workers that it hires. And so, you know, prior to a minimum wage increase, a business might be willing to hire workers who didn't graduate high school, who have relatively fewer skills. After a minimum wage increase, a business might say, okay, well, you know, we know that now that the minimum wage is $15 an hour, you know, we're going to be losing money every hour that our existing workforce is working. And so we're going to start hiring high school graduates who have relatively more skills. And so a business can absorb the cost of the higher minimum wage by increasing its productivity, by increasing its revenue per hour. And one way to do that is to hire a different type of worker. Now, again, you see, you know, winners and losers in this story. The group of workers who are made worse off are the workers who didn't graduate high school and now have fewer employment opportunities. The business is still okay because it has higher labor costs, but it changes its hiring practices so that it has a different type of worker working at the store. And so I think that, you know, for people who are trying to decide whether or not this is a good public policy, I think thinking about those trade-offs is a good idea.
Is there another argument that if you had a higher minimum wage, even with the existing employee base, you would tend to have less turnover, which in turn would ultimately, in a sense, reduce labor costs? In other words, that with a minimum wage as low as it is right now, it seems to me that there's not a lot of incentive to stay on any job. But with a higher minimum wage, you might be able to retain personnel for longer. I know that that's an argument that some liberal economists have made. What's your take on that?
Oh, I think that argument's absolutely right. And so that's another way a business can absorb these costs is by reduced turnover, because turnover is expensive. And that's related to a couple other ways businesses can absorb these costs. You know, one way is by spending less money hiring new workers, spending less money training new workers. And so these are, I think, absolutely ways that businesses can absorb higher costs. You know, I think we see, at least my own research finds, that big minimum wage increases affect employment more than smaller minimum wage increases. And I think when you're talking about smaller minimum wage increases, a lot of these factors are at play. Businesses are reluctant to kind of change the way they do business. They're reluctant to change the structure of their workforces. They're reluctant to change the types of workers they hire. And so, you know, if they can absorb a minimum wage increase by, reduced turnover, reduced training costs, reduced hiring costs, by charging slightly higher prices for their goods and services, you know, these are ways of absorbing those costs that they turn to. And so you tend to see more modest effects on employment from more modest increases in the minimum wage. But as the size of the minimum wage increase grows and grows, those sorts of mechanisms become less and less efficacious. There's a limit to how high you can raise your prices. There's a limit to how much reduced turnover can absorb higher labor costs. There's a limit to efforts you can take to make your workforce more productive. And so if you're talking about going to 15, which in many states would be more than double their minimum wage, you know, there I think you're really putting businesses in a situation where they have no choice but to reduce their hiring opportunities. But for more modest minimum wages, certainly I think some of those other mechanisms are very important parts of the story.
One of the reasons people say the minimum wage needs to be increased is really to provide a basic cost of living or be able to match a basic cost of living for these workers. But it feels like then it's having the business's shoulder that perhaps social responsibility of making sure that every employee has a living wage. Is that fair to put on the businesses? And if not, who's the best person to kind of hold that ball?
Well, so this is one of the kind of key underlying issues with the minimum wage that I think doesn't get nearly enough attention. You know, the people who advocate for a higher minimum wage make arguments that, if you are working full time and heading a household, you shouldn't live in poverty. And if you are working full time and you have, three kids or something like that, and, two or three kids, and you're earning $7.25 an hour, then you're going to be in poverty. And they point to that situation as being inherently unjust, and argue that therefore employers should be raising wages and should be paying wages that are above the poverty line. I think there's a strong appeal to that argument, and I think it gets some things right. I think as a society we should have a goal that no one who works full time and heads a household lives in poverty. Where I part company with minimum wage proponents is that, I don't think the burden for meeting that goal should rest solely on the businesses who employ those workers. I think that wages are driven fundamentally by economic forces like productivity. Of course, there's a role for non-market forces in determining wages as well, but at the end of the day, if you're a worker who is able to produce $10 an hour in revenue, it's just not going to make sense to hire you at 15. So I think it's unrealistic to expect businesses to bear the full burden of keeping workers out of poverty. I think instead what you will see happen is that businesses will just hire fewer of those workers. And that's where poverty becomes a real problem, is people aren't working. That's the primary driver of poverty. In addition, I think the logic of the minimum wage lets the rest of society off the hook. The goal that no one who works full-time and heads a household should live in poverty is a social goal. That's a goal that society should agree to, and I fully support that goal. Therefore, I think it makes the most sense for resources from all of society to be used to help meet that goal, not just resources from McDonald's and Walmart and from businesses that happen to employ a large share of lower wage workers. And so, I think programs that redistribute income that's drawn from all of society, from economists and hedge fund managers and law firms and businesses that really don't employ low wage workers. We need to have all of those folks pitching in as well. And that's why I think you want to rely on income redistribution more than on the minimum wage to meet that goal.
We could easily segue into a conversation about universal basic income, but I'm afraid we're going to have way more questions than we're going to have time to get to. I wanted to ask one in particular, though, which is, you talked about how there would be a dramatic increase in minimum wage in certain parts of the country if we went from a 7 to a 15, and it would be less dramatic in other parts where, indeed, the minimum wage in some states is already at the $15 level. To what extent have there been policy proposals floated that would be a little more nuanced, that would have different minimum wages across the country, even if using some kind of cost of living adjuster, even if implemented at a federal level?
Well, so implemented at a federal level is one way to do it. I mean, another way to do it is to just stick with the current system, where we have a relatively low federal minimum wage that isn't really binding for most workers, but that does establish a floor. And then we let states decide if they want to go higher, and we let states decide how much higher they might want to go. And so, my response to a lot of the people who are arguing that we should have the federal government set different minimum wages for different states is, you know, well, why not just stick with the current system where states set different minimum wages for themselves? And you have many different minimum wages across many different states. But I do think that would be preferable. I mean, look, you know, there are a lot of states where, you know, well over a third of workers earn less than $15 an hour. There are three states where the median wage is $16.50. So 15 is getting pretty close to half of all workers in those states. And so, you know, I think a $15 an hour minimum wage makes a whole lot more sense in, you know, say New York State than it does in Mississippi or in Alabama. And so I think having the federal government set different minimum wage rates at different states, I think makes more sense than the federal government going to 15 everywhere. But I think it makes less sense than letting the states just decide what their minimum wages should be. Another sensible policy would be to increase the federal minimum wage, but by a modest amount. You know, that would be more sensible than more than doubling the federal minimum wage. So there are a lot of better options here, I think, than a national $15 minimum.
Before we go, I want to touch on one more issue that I know you've spoken to, which is intuitively, it would seem to me that indexing the minimum wage to inflation would make sense. You have issues with that. Can you explain why?
I do, yeah. So, you know, what are the key features of the minimum wage ever since it was adopted nearly a century ago is that it's been nominal. So the minimum wage goes up, but it's not indexed to inflation. And so as consumer prices grow and as wages grow, the bite of the minimum wage goes down. The current federal minimum of $7.25, which was signed into law by President George W. Bush, was a lot higher when President Bush signed it than it is today. Because of inflation. And so businesses, I think, perceive, so on the one hand, right, that's bad because if what you want is for the minimum wage to provide workers with a basic standard of living, that its ability to do that shrinks every year as other wages and prices in the economy grow and the minimum wage stays where it was. But on the other hand, it's good because businesses view the minimum wage increase as temporary. It is a temporary increase in their labor costs. And so a business might say, you know, in the face of a modest minimum wage, a business might say, okay, well, you know, we're going to have higher labor costs for the next couple of years, but, you know, the burden of this is going to shrink as we can raise our prices and as wages throughout the economy continue to grow. So it's kind of like your mortgage. You know your mortgage is typically nominal, and so you know you're writing a check for the same amount every year, and year 10 of your mortgage is a lot easier than year one because the actual inflation adjustment amount you're paying is going down every year as overall prices rise. If the minimum wage is indexed to inflation, then businesses no longer are going to say, okay, this is a permanent increase. This is a temporary increase that's going to erode over time with inflation. Businesses are going to say, well, geez, you know, my labor costs are just going to be higher now. And they're going to be higher every year in the future. And so I think businesses are going to be much more willing to make changes to their workforce and specifically to reduce their employment levels because they think the minimum wage because they understand that the minimum wage is actually kind of permanently higher. And my research shows that the reduction in employment is actually three times larger when states index their minimum wages than when they don't. So it looks like a big deal.
Thank you. You know, one of the great things about talking about economic studies, and years ago I was an economics major, is translating our theories and our assumptions and comparing them to empirical evidence, which is something I know you do, and something that, you know, I think would be really interesting on another conversation to talk about. How do we study some of these things in the real world rather than sort of in the theoretical world? But again, I want to thank you for spending time with us this morning. I wanted to talk a little bit again about something we're trying to do over the next few weeks here. We have been talking about the minimum wage the last couple of weeks. We're looking to book some guests in the near future about student debt. And again, we'll be trying to book guests who look at things from different sides of the aisle, the different perspectives, if you will. One of the interesting things about that I was just talking about with Mr. Strain a little bit is empirical studies. We didn't get to this, but there was a really interesting empirical study done in 1994 that people are still talking about on the minimum wage. And that was a study done by an economist named Alan Krueger, who ends up later going into the Clinton White House as an economist. And anyway, Krueger says, you know, traditional economic theory assumes that an increase in the minimum wage will cause a decrease in employment. And he says, you know, he stumbles upon the notion that there came a point in the early 90s where Pennsylvania did not approve a minimum wage increase, but New Jersey did. And he could look at single metropolitan areas and evaluate fast food employment, both before and after the minimum wage increase. And he writes this paper that basically comes out with the conclusion that, in fact, in New Jersey, where the minimum wage increased, employment did not decrease, but in fact increased. Now, this has set off an intellectual debate that's been going on for, almost 30 years now about unemployment. And one of the interesting things about economists and economic studies is that, unlike physical chemical scientists, they very rarely can run controlled experiments. So there are obviously questions about the validity of that study, and there have been a lot of debates about it over the years. But we will continue to be sort of looking for guests. If you have a suggestion for us on a topic and a set of guests, we'd love to hear from you. MountainMoney@kpcw.org.
And we are moving to our next guest. Our next guest wrote in a Forbes Coaches Council post, "With the pandemic, race-related violence, and sensational political contention, 2020 felt like a war zone for many. In 2020, it wasn't the flowers that were missing, it was women. It's being called the pink-collar recession." Joining us this morning to talk about COVID-19's impact to women in the workforce is Susan Madsen, founder and director of the Utah Women and Leadership Project, and inaugural Karen Haight Huntsman Endowed Professional Leadership at John M. Huntsman School of Business at Utah State University. Thank you for joining us this morning, Susan.
Good to be here today. Thanks for the invitation.
So the Institute for Women's Policy Research released a report on job losses and more women leaving the labor market due to the pandemic. Can you give us an overview of what happened nationally to women?
Sure. You know, there's many statistics that have come out this past year. But really early in the pandemic, from February to May, there were 11.5 million women who lost their jobs, compared to about 9 million men. So we know that men have obviously been impacted as well. But in every statistic that we get nationally, the women are really disproportionately affected. And so even in December, I thought this was interesting, in the U.S. economy, women actually... the job loss was 140,000 jobs just in December alone, and every one, all of them were held by women. So by early, just a few months ago, more than 4.3 million women had lost their jobs, and so many had left the workplace. And even the research that we do see coming out nationally says that women in the past few months have still been, considering leaving the workplace, and many have left altogether. Some have shifted from full-time to part-time. Lots and lots of changes in the past year for women when it comes to, pretty much everything in women's lives, right? Mm-hmm. But specifically in their choices, how many hours they're working, all of the choices around paid work.
Can we drill down a little bit on some of those law statistics? For example, I'm sure you've sort of looked at the job categories that were involved? In other words, to what extent were women's job losses disproportionate with respect to men working in the same categories of work?
Yeah, what we do know is that so many of the job losses have been in areas that women are, for a number of reasons, that are more employed with. And those are the food services, the hospitality, and so forth. So more women really do work in more of those categories, those lower income categories that were really disproportionately affected. So men's jobs and women's jobs are quite different, even within food services, even within some of the hospitality. And the ones where you have that occupation, what's called occupational segregation, the type of occupations that women actually are pulled more towards are the ones that have been most negatively affected. So you do see some men in those, but you see the ones that have been, you know, really affected the most are really predominantly women. And of course, I'm sure you know the research on people of color as well. So you do see some of those really frontline jobs where you couldn't just say, hey, I'm going to telecommute, I'm going to work at home. You see more of those types of jobs really being the people in those positions really being women of color, particularly Hispanic and Black women.
And it's not just job losses that women experienced. There was a study from Qualtrics and the Board List that found that women's careers have been disproportionately impeded.
Absolutely. That's been an interesting thing to follow. So you look at job loss in general, but then women's careers. And early on, the research you're citing, that was a pretty early study that looked at collected data from men and women. And more men were saying during this pandemic time, they were actually either staying pretty much the same or seeing more promotions. And more women were just fighting to even stay the same. When you, especially as you can imagine, women with children who are still at home. So that homeschooling, of course, even all the child care shut down early on, even though that's been open now, there's still some different dynamics with that. And so interestingly, even in the research now, and this has continued through the pandemic, women really feel like they are, and the research shows, that they really do continue to have the lion's share of the unpaid care work, the child care, the homeschooling, and so forth. We do know that men have, especially when you have a home with partners, right, that men have stepped it up to do more. But what's fascinating in probably three different studies is men will say that they do things about equal with women, and significantly less women say that those are equal. So there's a lot of kind of hidden unpaid care work that women tend to do, and some of it's really emotional labor. Yeah.
No, that makes sense. I know also the studies had asked, you know, if the employees have been more productive at home, and men, majority of men had said, like, yes, they had seen some increased productivity, and a majority of women said they hadn't. I want to find the woman who has, because I don't think that's possible.
Well, you know, it really matters if you have children, young children at home. Because, you know, in my case, I have 4 children and 2 grandchildren, but none of my children live at home anymore. So I've actually been more productive. So I would argue that just because I'm stuck at home and I actually do a ton of work, and it matters the kind of work that you do. But when you have children in the home, which I've spent years doing, but I don't have them now, that really is where you see the difference when you have you know, the homeschooling responsibilities, the uncertainty of care, the just trying to swing everything and not have the support that women who choose to work typically
That is really interesting. To what extent have there been studies that have tried to isolate out the children at home issues so that we could look at what happened to women's careers by separating the impact on those with children at home versus those without, like yourself?
There have been some. You probably know that we're actually in the middle of doing analysis. Our first brief will be out in a couple of weeks. April 6th is when We have it targeted to come out, but we have collected some of the most thorough data that can be collected here in the state of Utah. Over around 3,600 women participated with quantitative, and then we have a lot over 2,700 with just qualitative, with qualitative responses on top of quantitative. So we're going to try to get to some of that data. Some of them have attempted, but some of that research is just moving forward right now. So we're really excited to actually take a look at Utah women specifically and see how that plays out. But we have questions all over the place from all of the things that impact a woman's work, and that can be from mental health to worry about, you know, children, just taking care of children, to economic concerns, to burnout, and we had a scale that measures hope and so many things. So it's going to be really interesting. We'll have a report roll out every month, either from our stats data or our quantitative or our qualitative data, which should be super interesting. So there are studies now, like I said, that are just getting to some of those things where you separate the children at home, you know, by ages, income levels, jobs that you can either telecommute or not telecommute. You know, some of them you just can't. So there's going to be some fascinating data actually come forth in the near future.
And with regards to that Utah data, are you following these same workers throughout a point in time, or was this just a snapshot of where they were in the world when they completed the survey?
Just a snapshot. Yeah, with this many, we feel very fortunate. We worked really, really hard to get the amount of data that we have. So we collected it for the most part all through January. So you can think of, you know, now we're in March, you know, we're in a little bit of a different place, right? But in January, you know, just getting past the holidays and so forth, that's really, but those struggles from 2020 were really still alive and well.
Do you have any sense as to how the impact of the pandemic on women in Utah compares with other parts of the country?
You know, just looking at some of the data that's coming in, I think, you know, we're seeing some of the same themes with the national data. So I think there's going to be some similar things. We'll just have a deeper understanding. What we do know, however, is typically for most of the topics that we write reports on, like the wage gap, like unpaid care work, like, you know, any of the topics, what we do find is that Utah always follows national trends. However, in Utah, we tend to have more exaggerated. So in terms of the wage gap, when you, everyone in the country, you know, all states struggle with the wage gap for gender. But in Utah, we have it even more than the rest of the country. And so, and in terms of unpaid care work, everybody, you know, there's a gender issue in that throughout the country. But in Utah, we find that we actually have more, that women do more unpaid care work than women in other parts of the country. So that would, if you think about that logic, what I think, even though we won't have direct comparisons with national because we just collected Utah data, but I would see the same themes, but we'll see it more exaggerated. So more stress in terms of homeschooling, because women here oftentimes have more children, right? And so we'll see more of that stress, more of that time being taken for homeschooling, and the same with unpaid care. And when you have more children and more unpaid care work, then, and you don't have the support that you were used to, then you do see probably greater struggles with mental health, with stress, with burnout, and those things. So I think we'll follow national trends with the data that's been out there, but we'll see even more exaggerated, you know, numbers and percentages with that. What we do know from the data that I've looked at that's not published yet is that we do, I found this very fascinating, that we're seeing burnout in obviously there and for women, but we're seeing it with all categories, with all education levels, with all income levels, all race, you know, and ethnicities, that we're just seeing some real consistent burnout percentages the perceptions of burnout, I guess, with everybody. I thought that was interesting.
It's completely understandable as well. I don't want to leave our time with you without highlighting the fact that not only do you review these numbers and analyze them, but you also work with people and organizations to help retain and support women at all levels. Can you give us a highlight on that?
Absolutely. You know, there are very well-documented practices that are based on research, but also just best practices in the society about, you know, in times of crisis, but generally what you need to do as organizations, whether you're in government or for-profit or nonprofit or schools or universities, there's now really pretty established practices and policies that can be in place that really can help. And so that is we're not guessing in those ways anymore. And one of the biggest, we have a report from December that really did look at the top 100 best places to work for in the state of Utah and what they were doing and what they were seeing on their end. And the number one, of course, is flexible practices. And we've been saying that for years and years, but all of a sudden Utah, I have felt like Utah is about 15 years on those things behind most states in the country, but we've shifted so quickly into that that I think organizations are now saying, wait, maybe this can work. Maybe flexible practices can work. What we know is they can actually help women and men and families. And so that's something, you know, in the state of Utah, we do struggle a lot with childcare. And we would think that a lot of people say, well, you know, we should have a lot of women who do childcare in their home, but we really do struggle with really high quality, affordable daycare, childcare. And so one of the practices is maybe you can't, you know, put a child care center in your workplace, but have those conversations. Look at what resources are out there in the community. Help people understand solutions when they get stuck. Just start talking about those things. It's more of a public issue, not just a private issue these days. If you look at how other countries have been doing this, it really becomes more of a public issue, not just a private issue. I could go on and on, but there's just different kinds of flexible work, from job sharing to part-time to full-time, you know, all kinds of things that we can do. So bottom line, we just need to shake things up and not say, well, this is the way it's worked through the years, but to say, moving forward, let's look at the best ways to move forward to help women, to help men, to help families, to retain, you know, to promote and really to be more equitable moving forward.
Well, thank you for that. We've been speaking with Susan Madsen. She's a professor of leadership at the John M. Huntsman School of Business at Utah State University. Kiln provides beautiful and thoughtfully designed flex office spaces in the country and is opening its fifth location in Park City, Utah on April 1st in the New Park Town Center. The Utah-based company, in partnership with New Park Retail, EDA, and Serenity Construction, is transforming what was previously Jupiter Bowl into an all-inclusive, elevated flex office space and community. Joining us this morning to talk about this new space are Lee Redford, as well as Arian Lewis. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you. Nice to be able to be here.
Fantastic. Well, wanted to just kind of start out the conversation with, you know, a highlight for people what Kiln does and what type of office spaces you provide.
Okay. You bet. Lee, why don't you take that one?
Yeah, sure. Kiln's all about bringing people together to work together, and we provide various different types of desking and membership models that range from people who just need to casually drop in and work for a few hours at a time in our club membership style, right through to larger studio spaces that enable teams of up to 30 or even 50 work together and have fantastic office spaces that have their own internal meeting rooms. So we've considered really the different sizes and scales of businesses that we might need to accommodate. And what we're really looking for is kind of that cross-fertilization and collaboration between them. So within Kiln, you can come and have an initial membership into the club membership, which is, you know, you can just come on your own and you have a space to put your laptop down and plug in, right through to kind of permanent office spaces where your team can really grow in that space. You know, teams of 4, 8, 16, whatever it is, we can accommodate those within the shape, the spaces that we have.
Give us a little about your history. How long has Kiln been in business, and where are your other locations here in Utah?
Yeah, so we've been in business for about 2 years in operations. Lee and I actually have had about 8 years working together building a prior brand, a co-working brand. So the story of Kiln goes back, you know, further, but we're located here in Utah in Lehigh, Salt Lake, Park City. We've just recently opened a location in Boulder, Colorado, and we have locations under development in other states.
And give us some examples of a company that has gone through different stages within Kiln. I'm just trying to get a sense of how those relationships can evolve.
Sure. You know, we have companies that have been with us from the very inception. We've got Every is a great company as an example. They were they started their business at Kiln Salt Lake with only 4 people, and now I think they have over 30. They've grown, you know, steadily, and Kiln has provided a real flexible model for them to adapt and change their office needs with the with the changes in their business. We serve over 250 tech companies, primarily tech companies, throughout the state of Utah, about 1,100 to 1,200 members in Utah.
So one of the things that I read about when, you know, learning more about Kiln Park City is that you are dedicated to fostering growth for women-owned and startup businesses. How is this reflected in the business atmosphere you provide?
Yeah, so we recognize that the traditional office and environment in which businesses grow is oftentimes not friendly to, let's just say, female founders or founders from other diverse backgrounds. And so the benefit to Kiln and what we really focus on is creating programming, events, other opportunities for shared learning so that founders of a variety of backgrounds can learn, let's just say, from others who have gone through the same thing, as well as find better ways to integrate into maybe the main stream of the tech and startup ecosystem. My mother was a female entrepreneur. She built a business here in Utah. I remember her sitting around the table with a group of credit cards trying to figure out how to fund her business through credit cards because she couldn't get access to traditional financing or banking. And it was a real uphill battle for a lot of, particularly here in Utah, for a lot of women who are building businesses. At Kiln, we've just, from the very beginning, we've been very aware of, you know, what it's like for founders who may not either be from the mainstream of the tech ecosystem or even from a different background who need additional support. And we're very focused on making sure that Kiln is very inclusive and supports a wide variety and diverse set of creators.
What kinds of things do you do to facilitate collaboration between businesses?
Yeah, so within Kiln, we have a set of programmatic elements. So, for example, we do Waffle Wednesdays and Apri Work on Thursdays and mixers of a variety of types. But we also host a lot of events focused on knowledge sharing. So pre-pandemic, we were doing 20 to 30 events per month per location. And we expect to get back to those levels once the restrictions are lifted.
How many members?
Yeah, and I'll tell you that the design of the space is also something that was really critical to collaboration. We have things like the atrium space, which is a huge curved seating area where people can have conversations in the round of up to 30 people. And then throughout the space, there are breakout spaces, the kind of the way that our kitchen areas are developed. You know, it's not a kitchen against a wall, it's a counter. And around that counter, people can break bread, talk and share their experiences as they have lunch, coffee and that kind of thing. So every moment in the space is really, truly is considered to get people talking and connecting. And we think that's so critical to our success as it is to our membership too.
I know that many of our listeners will want to find out more about Kiln, and I also know that you're doing tours in April. Can you let them know how they can find out more?
You bet. We're doing tours on Thursday afternoons from 4 to 6 p.m. So you can come to one of those. Also go to kiln.co, K-I-L-N.co, and you can sign up for a tour and learn more about our membership offering.
And how many members do you have per location? Do you have a capacity? Will we run into a point where it's maxed out?
Yeah, we do expect that we'll get to a point where we have a waiting list. So we're the pace of membership sales in Park City has been very good. I think that all of the move-ins from other states and other folks kind of resettling in Park City has very much helped that. So I believe within 6 months, we'll be at that point where we'll have, there, certainly for some kinds of offices or membership types, there may be a waiting list. So, yeah.
Fantastic. Well, we've been speaking with owners Arian Lewis and Lee Redford regarding Kiln Park City opening on April 1st here in New Park.
I want to thank our sponsors. We could, of course, not do a show like this without our wonderful sponsors, Jan's Mountain Outfitters, First Community Bank, Columbus Pacific Development with Pendry Residences, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, and San Francisco Design.
And I'd like to thank our guest today. We spoke with Michael Strain regarding a $15 minimum wage. We've got Susan Madsen regarding women in the workplace and COVID. And then we just spoke with the founders of Kiln. You've been listening to Mountain Money, broadcast on KPCW, Park City, Utah. For more information, please visit kpcw.org. Please take a moment and give us a rating on your podcast app.